Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program was brought to you by Emmy Cheese, specialty cheese from Switzerland made with heart and passion. For more information, visit emmyusa.com.
Ever heard of a popcorn-driven robot? This week on Meat and Three, we're bringing you stories about the intersection of food and tech.
We're interested in building swarms of many cheap, small robots and powering them and driving them forward with as little effort and as little energy as possible.
We cover tech by land.
Imagine if you could cut fresh microgreens onto your salad and eat it while the greens are still fresh and nutritious and delicious and alive. That dream is real.
We cover tech by sea.
We're building software-based business services to help shellfish growers manage and grow their business.
And we cover tech in the social media stratosphere.
So it's not really necessarily an indictment on food media or media consumption at all. It's how the robots decided that they were going to weight human interaction.
Tune in and get techie this week on Meat and Three, available on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Welcome to Cutting the Curd on the Heritage Radio Network. This is your host, Elena Santigade. Today I'm on site in Pittsburgh at the 2018 American Cheese Society Conference. This yearly conference is fun and inspiring for many reasons, but one of the best elements is the chance to connect with other cheese people from around the country who you don't get to see very often. In that spirit, I'm thrilled to be sitting here with Gordon Edgar, a certified cheese celebrity and repeat guest on Cutting the Curd. Thanks for taking the time to chat, Gordon.
Can you really be a certified cheese celebrity? I'm not really sure that's a thing.
I am certifying you as a cheese celebrity. Okay, so listeners, if you haven't listened yet, be sure to check out the two Cutting the Curd book review episodes where Diane chats with Gordon about each of his books. The first, Cheesemonger, Life on the Wedge, and the second, Cheddar, A Journey to the Heart of America's Most Iconic Cheese. Those are episodes number 155 and 241. So, aside from perfectly penning the cheesemonger experience and diving deep into the history of the much-beloved cheddar cheese, Gordon is the cheese buyer at the famed worker-owned cooperative Rainbow Grocery in San Francisco. A few weeks ago, Yuri and Britt of the Park Slope Food Co-op in Brooklyn came on the show, and ever since, my mind has been all abuzz thinking about alternative approaches to retail in food. So, Gordon, let's get to it.
Let's get to it.
Okay, Rainbow Grocery, for our listeners who don't know it, what's your, like, elevator pitch recap? What's going on? What is it? Why is it so special?
Well, you know, we're San Francisco's largest independent natural food store, you know, so that's number one. Number two is that we're kind of one of the last survivors of this thing that was called the People's Food System in San Francisco, and we've grown from being a small volunteer-run grocery store that all followed the same guru to being like a 215-person worker-owned cooperative, one of the biggest worker-owned businesses in the country.
Wow. Okay, so it started from a volunteer basis. And was it sort of like a buying club, like a group of wackos who had a truck and went and got food?
Yes.
That's great. That seems to be... That seems to be a constant among successful food co-ops.
The way that it really worked was in the late 60s, I mean, food is always a political issue, right? Yeah. But in the late 60s, things were especially politicized, especially in the Bay Area. You know, there was a lot of, you know, there's a lot of stuff, Black Panthers, you know, feeding children programs. There was a lot of stuff in San Francisco also, these programs where people would just get food and serve it to people in the parks. Mm. And that happened through the kind of mid to late 60s. And there was buying clubs all over the place. And but what people found was two things. One is that with volunteer buying clubs, there was often a lot of turnover. Like it was the kind of responsibilities started falling on the same small group of people. Right. Also, they felt like, you know, less packaged, more affordable, more healthy food should be available to everyone. So, and this is telescoping history a little bit,
right.
But basically people decided instead of these kind of volunteer, you had to be a member buying clubs, they would start a series of storefronts that would sell food in different neighborhoods. And the idea is if you came into our store in the Mission and you lived out in the Sunset, you'd be like, you know, you should start your own store over there. Different economic climate at the time. It was very easy to start a store at that point. Very different from today, but that's the reality.
Right.
And the last thing to say about the people's food system is, you know, it was really an attempt to change the food system. It had not just storefronts, but distribution collectives, trucking collectives, and producer collectives. And unfortunately did not last very long. By the end of the 70s, there was a lot of problems, a lot of infighting, and just, you know, the whole kind of food movement was like kind of falling apart, basically.
Yeah, I mean, when we were chatting with the Park Slope Food Co-op crew, it was sort of a similar history on the East Coast in terms of like tons of co-ops starting in the 70s and the longevity basically boiling down to just a small handful that actually made it. So Park Slope is a member-owned cooperative with staff, sort of more of a traditional like staffing and management structure, although traditional should not be the word I use because it's that's
professional.
Scratch
but not.
That. Yes, that's much better. Professional management and staff description. But tell the listeners a little bit more about what a worker-owned cooperative actually means. And you know, in the Rainbow Grocery example, like how do the logistics work out?
Well, you know, in the Park Slope Food Co-op, which is an amazing place, like, you know, it's really, really a great example for everybody. You know, you have to be a member to shop there. And if you're a member, you also have to work to keep your membership.
Right.
That's how theirs works. With us, to anybody coming in off the street, we're a normal grocery store.
Ah.
But if you work there, you have to be an owner. And you have to, you basically get hired like any other job, but you have to become a member. And then the people who own it are the 215 of us who happen to be, you know, the amount of people we need to staff the store.
Wow. And so does owning it as a worker owner, are you also putting a financial investment into the business? Listeners, the reason we're giggling is we are sitting in the middle of the conference center in Pittsburgh, and all of Gordon's fans and friends,
that was the ACS directors,
big fans of yours, I'm sure.
You know, it's a little. Our history is a little more confusing than I made it because our co-op started with basically about 10 people who followed the same guru, and all were brought together in the belief in right livelihood, which means basically, you know, doing good things in the world and, you know, putting good things into the community.
Wow, what a concept.
Yeah. That Rainbow became secular pretty early on. It only took about like a year, and this is back in the 70s, like 75, 74,
right.
75. But we were incorporated as a not-for-profit religious institution for a long time. Eventually, there became a law where we could actually incorporate as a worker-owned cooperative, which is our legal structure.
Got it.
And we took advantage of that and changed our bylaws and all that to reflect that. But because we'd been around for a while, we didn't need kind of the equity kick in. We already had equity.
The initial buy-in wasn't as necessary.
Yeah, exactly. So our buy-in to the store is only when you've been there about 9 months, you pass a series of orientations and tests, and get voted in as a member, you only have to buy $10 voting share, one $10 voting share.
Wow.
And then you're an owner of the business. And the important thing, I think, to know about co-ops, and you probably cover this with Park Slope, but you know, it's like we have, no matter how many shares you might have invested in Rainbow, you only have one voting share. There's only 215 votes.
So one worker member, one vote.
Exactly. But basically what happens is as you're there, you get designated every year at the end of the year your share of the profit that the store makes. And it's based mostly, I'm simplifying a little, but it's based mostly you know, I do like an hour and a half orientation on this, and we just don't have time for that. But, but it's based mostly on your hours work compared to everybody else's hours work.
Ah, okay.
So I might work, you know, 0.5 hours of all hours worked, and then I'll roughly get 0.5% of all the profits.
So it's almost a sweat equity sort of structure in that sense for profits.
Exactly, exactly. Huh. And then, you know, because a business can't run without capital, we keep a certain amount of that in the business.
Right.
And so we get that, we get some amount awarded to us in cash and some in shares. And then we actually can't draw out our shares until they reach a certain amount. So that's another way we keep equity in the business.
Ah, so almost like a vesting schedule or something.
Exactly, exactly. And so while we only have a $10 voting share, you know, when you've been there as long as me, you have to keep in about $30,000 in the business.
Okay. So. Okay. So interesting. So now how did you guys know how to legally set that up? I mean, is it like somebody had a buddy who's a lawyer? Kind of sketched out on a napkin for a while, and then at some point someone's buddy was a lawyer?
No, actually, you know, it's funny. It was... Yeah, like I said, for a long time we were a not-for-profit religious institution. Long after that didn't really apply to us. But the laws were changing, and this is state by state. So, you know, your state might be very different. But in California, there became a statute where you could incorporate as a worker-owned cooperative. Mm. And the lawyer who wrote that statute happened to live in Berkeley and know people who work in the store. So he was our lawyer, basically, who incorporated us as a worker-owned cooperative. It was very handy.
Very convenient.
Very convenient.
The writer of the law happened to be the guy who helps you.
Makes me feel like I'm big business or something like that.
Yeah, you had an insider guy there, Gordon. Okay, so here's a question. And maybe, I'm not sure if you are privy to say, but can you give us some sense of what your yearly sales are like at Rainbow?
Oh, yeah, we sell, our store sells, I honestly don't know what it is for last, we don't have our report for last year yet, but it's around $54 million a year.
Wow. And do you have, I imagine you have a sense of what the cheese department is doing of that.
Yeah, we do about 4% of the sales at the store.
4%. Awesome.
Yeah, 2% of the footprint, 4% of the sales.
Ah, that's a good ratio.
Point that out.
Yep, yep. Important ratio there, Gordon.
All the other buyers out there know what I'm talking about.
And what about, so staff-wise, tell us a little bit about the cheese department at Rainbow.
Well, let me explain Rainbow a little bit, too, because I think this would be helpful to understand.
Okay, great.
You know, everybody, when they get hired to Rainbow, gets hired into a home department, okay. Of which cheese is one of 14 departments. Some of those departments are sales-oriented, and some of them are not sales-oriented. Hmm. Like, we have an office department, we have a maintenance department, cashier department. None of those generate revenue, but they're necessary for us to exist, right? Mm-hmm. So everybody gets hired into one of those departments, and that's where most of your day-to-day work is and most of your day-to-day interaction with other coworkers.
So it's sort of like a shift team in a way. Well, I like context. Okay,
favorite.
Okay, good, good. listeners, don't try to map this onto your normal understanding. Clean slate here.
But, I mean, the best way to think about it is it's almost like it's 14 different collectives within one structure.
Okay.
Because all the departments are pretty semi-autonomous. There's certain agreements we've made as a whole. I mean, our store was founded by vegetarian hippies. We do not carry meat in our store, which comes as a shock to a lot of people, including many customers.
Yes, that means no prosciutto, people.
No prosciutto. Luckily for my future in cheese, even though I was not involved in 1974, they decided that since they were vegetarian, it was important not to get too picky about rennet and cheese.
Yeah, because you could have a big problem on your hands.
Well, they just said vegetarians needed protein, so rennet would be an acceptable thing, luckily,
phew,
in the future. So basically, you know, there's certain things we decide as a whole in the whole store, and that's all 215 of us, either on a ballot vote or being in the same room voting on something.
And that's kind of like a bylaws sort of situation, or?
Well, bylaws are actually even more serious, but it depends. We have a set of bylaws, which are honestly pretty generic because we didn't want to change them, but it's very hard to change those. It's 2/3 of the membership has to vote to change a bylaw. I don't think vegetarianism is actually in our bylaws. That would change with a majority vote.
Okay.
But I don't see it happening anytime soon.
No.
I mean, it's hard. You know, it's like, I mean, I eat meat, but, you know, it's like, you have people who have been working there 40 years who are committed vegetarians, and kind of a slap in the face as if we'd, like, turned around and voted it down.
Yeah, plus, like, there's something to the original intention there, you know, and there's ways to get meat.
But I'd like to get it with my discount.
Yeah, that's true. It's a bummer for you.
It is. Yeah, I've got to go somewhere else to shop, you know. But in the department itself, in the cheese department, we really, I'm the buyer. It's funny because everybody knows me and people really want to treat me when I go out into the world like I'm the boss or the manager. And it's actually really not the case. It's just I was the only one who could put up with schmoozing at first. When I first started going to ACS, the ACS was local. It was in, Rohnert Park was the first one I went to. And, that's just up the road. And it's like nobody else wanted to go and like schmooze with people in suits. So I said, well, I'll do it, you know. And thus began your career as the
cheese buyer.
Exactly. But in terms of organizational structure, I am the buyer, and that is a job that my department has voted me into.
Right, that is a specific role, but it doesn't mean that you're the manager.
Right, exactly. I don't have final say on personnel decisions. I don't have say in schedule. I mean, I have say, but I don't have the final say in those things.
I gotta say, Gordon, sounds pretty good.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome.
I mean, best of both worlds here.
Shh, don't tell anybody that.
Too bad this is recording on the radio.
No, but I mean, we all take turns doing those things. Like, I'm currently on the hiring committee. So that means hiring. That also means firing if people are not working out in the first few months. You know, so we just take turns doing that stuff. But my job is a job that's like codified by, these are the decisions I'm authorized to make, and things I'm responsible to do. And that's what I do.
Wow. So cool. Okay. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be back for more about Rainbow Grocery and Gordon Edgar. And we'll get into some more activist cheese talk. listeners, stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Today's program was brought to you by Emmy Cheese, specialty cheese from Switzerland made with heart and passion. Since the early 1900s, Emmy has been a passionate supporter of farmers, cheesemakers, and family tradition. They believe in sustainable agriculture and respect for the people, land, and animals that make their business possible. Remaining dedicated to tradition, they strive to lead the industry in innovation, ensuring they bring you only the highest quality, best-tasting cheese from Switzerland. Emmy is best known for importing more than 80% of the Swiss Gruyere into the United States, but that's not to overshadow their other specialty cheeses, including Kaltbach cave-age cheeses, Der Scharfe Max, Appenzeller, Tête de Moine, and traditional Emmentaler. For more information, visit emmyusa.com.
Hi, I'm Moxie Rosenblum. My dad, Harry Rosenblum, hosts Feast Your Ears on Heritage Radio Network. Right now, HRN is having a summer membership drive. Becoming a member is so easy, and you'll help support shows like my dad's. You can sign up for a one-time donation or become a monthly sustaining member by visiting heritageradionetwork.org/donate. Let's keep food radio on the airwaves this summer.
Welcome back to Cutting the Curd on the Heritage Radio Network. Listeners, if you're just tuning in, if you've downloaded this and somehow you're in the very middle of the show, is that even possible? Okay, maybe not.
I just turned on my car and here it was, halfway through.
I don't know how that works with Heritage. But whatever, if you need to listen to the first half of the episode, or if you were so delighted by hearing about this unique setup that they've got at Rainbow Grocery, the largest...
Probably the largest retail
worker-owned cooperative in the U.S. It's just been a fascinating discussion so far. So,
I should say, too, Park Slope always says they're the largest worker-owned because everyone who shops there is also an owner.
Right.
So we've had this back and forth. We have slightly different...
I like keeping that kind of disagreement alive.
Okay, well, I just don't want to diss them. I'm on their side. Yeah. I love them. I think they're great.
Yeah, there's space...
No intra-co-op drama.
No, definitely not. There's too few of us to have drama. And as a member of the Park Slope Food Co-op for 10 years, I think your definition is totally valid. Okay, so Let's talk a little bit about, since we were, you know, sort of left off on the cheese department at Rainbow, I'm sure that our cheese-loving listeners are going to be curious about how you curate that department and what the look is like. So let's talk a little bit about how many cheeses do you have? What's the deal like? Why are you, what's your sort of philosophy as a buyer? How do you choose it? What's going on?
Well, you know, we carry, you know, it's funny, in our department we actually also carry the fake cheese too, so I should probably mention that.
Oh, but you mean the fermented nut product, exactly. As I wanted to refer to it in my book, but wasn't
it's
allowed to.
Cheese, you know, whatever we want to call it. But yeah, we have any given time, we have about 500 SKUs in our department. That includes the crackers and the fake cheese and stuff like that. But, you know, we really try to have a mix. You know, we have cheese for people, you know, we're an old co-op, you know, we have 40-pound blocks. I mean, in terms of volume, you know, what we sell most of is probably 40-pound block of mild cheddar or Monterey Jack.
Totally.
We sell for $5 a pound, you know, and we got to have cheese for people that need, you know, cheaper cheese to survive.
Totally.
But then we also try to really, you know, we try to have it both ways. We also try to really represent, you know, great farming practices, great cheese making practices. You know, some things we love, we've always been a big supporter of Conte because, you know, only name control that has to be made in a co-op.
Ah, like-minded. I mean,
maybe somebody will know a different one and follow up. But
yeah, listeners, I'm going to trust Gordon's knowledge on this topic, but we'll see.
But, you know, we really try to introduce, you know, we really have, I mean, at this point it's kind of introduced, but, you know, for a long time we really worked to introduce new American cheeses into the market and really work on that, especially new California cheeses. You know, and that's I think not just us, but that's kind of mission accomplished. People know those cheeses now.
Totally.
You know, so we try to work with other really, you know, as well as having all the basics and everything you'd expect, we try to pick out things that have good for political reasons as well. Mm-hmm. It's not the bottom line. It's not like we check people like who they voted for or anything like that. But you know, like if there's a great project that that we think helps, you know, small farms survive or is a really interesting like biodiverse project of some sort, you know, we're definitely going to go try to support it.
Very cool. You know, I think that sort of lens, that filter, I guess, is not, you don't usually hear about buyers taking the moment to have that filter in their selection. So it's neat to hear that.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's fun. I mean, you know, it's like, I'm not, you know, some of that stuff, you have the luxury of, you know, being in a very busy grocery store. So you don't necessarily need that stuff to make us a ton of money. You know, and somewhere down the line, it might be very profitable. So things have moved from being a project we wanted to support to being like, you know, a staple. You know, say something like Rush Creek, for instance. You know, when we carried that, you know, we were in the first wave of West Coast stores who had that. Mm-hmm. Nobody knew what the heck that was, you know, and you know, but God, what a great cheese, what a great story, what a great practice.
And no problem selling that one.
Well, no, now it's like, you know, 3 weeks before it arrives, people start asking and we make a list, you know.
I love that.
That problem, right?
Yeah, that's the best thing that could possibly happen. That task is highly sought after. Okay, so now that we know a little bit, you know, a lot more about how Rainbow works and how this worker-owned cooperative model exists, like, in your point of view, because you've been there since 1994, is that right?
Yes.
So, from your point of view, also living in San Francisco, which is the only other city I know of that's in as big of a constant, you know, magnifying glass of wage inequality and the rent is too damn high, and you know you're facing all the issues that we talk about all the time in New York City. You know, do you feel like having a business of this with this kind of business structure has helped you stay in San Francisco? Has it, you know, is it, how does it fit into the political, the kind of like the larger dynamic there in the city?
Well, I think that you know, some things are always out of our control, right? I mean, I would say, before San Francisco started going so crazy, I mean, our turnover for a 200-plus person, you know, retail grocery store was under 10% a year. I mean, it was really tremendously low. At one point, the cheese department had 5 people who'd worked in cheese for 20 years.
That's incredible. That's unheard of.
You know, so all of that, amazing. People want to stay for the most part. Unfortunately, you know, there's the reality of the way that it is in San Francisco now. And I grew up in the Bay Area, so, you know, it's especially painful to me. Mm-hmm. But I'm the only one of those 5 20-year-plus people left because Of the other four, three of them basically got gentrified out of the city, lost their apartments, and had to leave. The other had been studying to be a librarian, and she's a librarian now. But
great cheese, thing to be.
You should have a. Have you had a show on cheese and librarians?
Now I have to say, I saw a little like blurb that you wrote, I think on your website ahead of your library tour your book, and I thought this is the most spectacular idea. The similarities between librarians and cheesemonger just. Yeah. The people, the world, the work.
Yeah, well, there's your next show.
Yeah, we got to do it. We got to do it. Thank you, Gordon.
What were we talking about? Oh, right, yeah. But, I mean, you know, it's hard. I mean, it's hard, you know, first of all, the pay structure at Rainbow, which I didn't really talk about.
Yeah, how does that work?
Everybody starts at the same wage. And, you know, right now that's, what is it? We just changed it as of July 1st. So it's somewhere in the 16s.
Okay. And do you also start people with benefits?
After 3 months, benefits.
Got it.
You know, and there's other things that you also, not even just benefits, but other ways, like you get money as well. But just keep it simple for this, you know.
Okay.
But you know, you get more money the longer you've been there, based on cost of living increases and based on, you know, a couple of raises a year, potentially. Mm-hmm. But your pay is not associated with your job.
So interesting. Tell me more.
If I stopped being the buyer tomorrow, my pay rate would be exactly the same. You know, if I was just, you know, picking up carts in the parking lot, or, you know, up in the office doing HR or doing cheese buying, my same wage is the same.
I love this because a lot of times I feel like the thing that boggles me most about sort of the more mainstream, you know, capitalist approach to business plans is like you're weighing the value of different roles so differently, you know. And people, whenever I bring this up in mixed company, people always say like, oh, well, that role is paid so much more because not anyone can do it. And I always find that argument to be like pretty hollow. And it's just like not a generous way to do business. So it's neat to hear about this, that your wage really, it's not connected to the specifics of the role that you play.
Well, and I think that, you know, not everybody can necessarily do every job.
Correct.
For sure.
I do allow for that.
But every job is valuable.
Exactly.
And you know, people have tried things out. I mean, this is another way of like, you know, you can try out something, and if it doesn't work, you're not like penalized, you know, you're not incredibly penalized.
Right. Like it encourages a culture of innovation in a way.
Well, we hope so. You know, it definitely, like, you know, you could apply for that job and work in the office just doing bookkeeping if we have an opening and you get hired, and maybe you're not the best bookkeeper. You know, so instead of the problem of them then having to like figure out a way to fire you, you know, you can have a discussion or whatever and maybe move on to a different department.
Right.
Without any kind of penalty. Just because that wasn't the job for you. I mean, that's in a perfect world.
Not
every example is a perfect world example, but
right. I'm sure there's, you have your share of issues here. Okay, so tell us a little bit about, like, what would you say is the top benefit of a place like Rainbow in the structure, and maybe the biggest downfall.
Well, I'd say they're almost one and the same, which is there's this joke that that some of us have had for years, which is the need to institute an oppression sabbatical, which would be like, once you start taking Rainbow for granted, you should go like work somewhere else for a year, not be allowed to come back. And then like, okay, after a year you can come back and then you'll appreciate it more. I think that sometimes people forget like how much the power is in their hands and how much they could take responsibility. Sometimes sometimes it sucks. You know, sometimes it sucks when somebody you like is doing something that is detrimental or potentially a legal problem, and you have to deal with that either through discipline or through eventually termination. I mean, that's no fun, and there's no one to slough it off on. You can't be like, oh, that damn boss, they got to deal with this problem. You know, you got to deal with it.
Right.
So that sucks, but it's also day in, day out, it's great to not have a boss.
Yeah, and it's like that element that sucks is like sort of a natural human element to anything that sort of is always going to be sucky when humans are involved, I feel like.
I think that the one thing that we really miss is, you know, sometimes, you know, there's a workplace camaraderie because your management is so terrible that everybody else gets along really well. But, like, since everybody has, like, kind of fingers in different parts of the operation, you know, you don't have that crazy solidarity against someone. You have to find solidarity with people.
I think that's a pretty good trade-off. I'm going to say you're better off. You're not missing out on so much, on something so awesome there.
But I would say that it's actually sometimes hard for people who haven't worked in a co-op before and start there to, like, they still think there's somebody they should be reacting.
Right.
When they first get there. And sometimes it takes a few years for people to realize that there actually isn't, like, a boss.
I'm sure that's a huge adjustment. It's like rewiring the brain. Okay, so since we're sitting here at ACS, we're at a cheese conference.
We are.
Although I will say actually. That Gordon and I are sitting looking over another area of the conference center where there is a legit pinball conference happening, and we are... After this interview, I think we're going to try to figure out how to sneak into it. But this leads me to my question of, I heard somewhere along the way in my research, I heard it mentioned that you also attend worker-owned cooperative conferences. Is that a thing? Is that true?
Well, yeah. You know, it's funny. Originally, way back a million years ago, Kathleen Shannon Finn tried to recruit me to be on the ACS board of directors.
Uh-huh.
But I was, and I wish I could have been. But at that moment, Rainbow was one of a few co-ops in the country that was trying to organize the United States Federation of Worker Cooperatives. Because, you know, the United States had actually has never had a formal organization for worker co-ops. And one of the few industrialized countries that doesn't. In fact, for years, Canada represented us at the world conferences. For
unbelievable.
It's kind of cool, actually, in some ways.
I like that, but also I'm
thanks,
like...
Thank you, Canada.
Thank you, Canada. And also, U.S. What?
But you know, because most of the co-ops here were consumer co-ops. A lot of them, I mean, this is generalizing, but a lot of them came from Scandinavian immigrants, started food co-ops. They're more consumer co-op oriented until kind of the... There are exceptions, of course, but until the wave of the 60s and 70s. I would get these calls. I was on the committee at Rainbow that dealt with people who had co-op questions from other stores, people who wanted to convert to co-ops or who wanted to, start a co-op. And we just didn't have the resources. I mean, we were, you know, we started in 1974 with, you know, people had probably had a few $100. They probably didn't, who knows if they even had a license. I mean, I'm not saying they didn't. I'm just saying it was a different time.
Yeah, I'm not going to worry about that. You know, we don't need to worry about that.
But, you know, like very little capital, they were able to, like, start this kind of thing. And that's just not the reality of the situation. But we don't have the experience with what a startup co-op would be in 2018, you know.
Right.
At this point, it would be 2006 or whatever it was. Rainbow, we actually sent 8 people to Minneapolis along with another 250 or so co-op people from around the country.
Wow.
And we formed the U.S. Federation of Worker Co-ops. So I wasn't ever a board member there, but I was helping start that and also a member of the committee that worked on our regional West Coast conferences, because the U.S. Federation is kind of divided up into 4 regions. And so we were trying to keep a West Coast conference, like, vibrant and alive. So
cool.
We would have national conferences every other year and regional conferences every other year.
Got it. And these were all different types of businesses, not just food retail, right?
No, food retail was in the minority for sure. You know, at that point, you know, at one point there was a lot of big co-ops. Unfortunately, a lot of them have closed down for various reasons, but there was, you know, Good Vibrations, mail order, you know, sex toys, and et cetera. There was Alvarado Street Bakery, that's food, but and then there was Burley Bikes, who made the bike trailers. All of us were, co-ops of size, who, you know, were over 150 members or so, or over 100 members. And there's lots of other little ones too, but it was a really interesting period. But now, you know, now it's a little different. Things have kind of switched around. The U.S. Federation is definitely out there as a resource in a way that we'd never had before.
Uh-huh.
So I don't get those questions from somebody in Illinois who wants to start a tech co-op that I have no idea how to help. Right. You know, I get to say, you can call the U.S. Federation and ask them for help.
Okay, so it's that's great for you. I'm glad it's off your shoulders.
I mean,
yeah,
I had nothing to say. I mean, I was like, yeah, awesome, great.
Yeah, good luck. So, okay, so for any listeners that are, might be thinking about starting a business or already help to run or own business, they should look into, say it once again, the name of the federation.
It's the U.S. Federation of Worker Cooperatives. And there is technical assistance available. They have like a whole series where they're training people to do technical assistance. Often, you know, it depends a little bit on the details, but often they have somebody who can help at least for a few hours to help get things off the ground or to see if things are working. I mean, I think that really, you know, as we look at the consolidation of the artisan cheese business, I mean, I would personally love to see, you know, conversion on the table as an option. You know, the problem is capital, of course, as it always is.
Right. There's
still not a lot of capital in the worker cooperative movement. So being able to come in and, you know, build a new barn and build new, you know, put in new vats and stuff, I mean, that's a tricky thing. It would have to be worked out. But hopefully we're getting there to the point where that's going to be more of a real option.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And I think the interesting, you know, we've had a few shows where we've touched on these ideas. Andy Hatch came on and gave a little sort of rah-rah challenge to the industry to kind of rethink the family-sized business sector at all points in the supply chain. And I think that this could apply to cheesemakers, to retailers, to distributors even, to, you know, to everyone who's involved in the industry. So it's very interesting ideas here, Gordon.
Well,
thank you for your insight.
You're very welcome. You're very welcome.
Oh, man. So, also, thank you for taking time out of the business busy conference schedule to chat.
I really wasn't doing anything. Sitting out of my room. I don't know.
Well, maybe pre-busy.
I got things to do right now after this, but
right.
Until now, you're my first thing I had to do today.
Awesome. Well, this was such a pleasure and super inspiring. Listeners, thank you for tuning in. We want to keep this conversation going, too. So if you have questions or ideas about alternative business models for the cheese industry, you can email us at cuttingthecurd@heritageradionetwork.org or tweet us at cuttingthecurd. We'll be back next week with more from the cheese world.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.